It is nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. Broadcasting on 100.1 FM, it is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 42 degrees under overcast skies. Out at the airport, they have southeast winds down to 8 miles per hour, and they are up to 10 full miles of visibility. Look for a chance of rain this afternoon, followed by a slight chance of rain after 4 p.m. Mostly cloudy today, mostly cloudy tonight, and rain is expected on Saturday, mainly before 4 p.m. Look for south winds to 15 for today, coming down to 5 tonight, but turning around to the southeast and coming up as high as 30 miles per hour tomorrow. Coming up on the Midday Report, a new partnership will monitor Kodiak Island beaches for harmful algal blooms. A new letter from the federal government says Alaska's education department owes $30 million to four school districts. They didn't divvy up COVID-19 money right, according to the Fed.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. For 11 days, Israeli forces have been raiding for the second time what was once Gaza's largest and most advanced hospital. Israel's military says militants were using the hospital and that its forces have killed 200 fighters and detained hundreds more. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports journalists have also gone missing.
In the first hours of the raid, freelance journalist Bayan Abu Sultan posted online that Israeli forces were ordering people to leave their homes in western Gaza City and targeting buildings near Al-Shifa Hospital, severely wounding civilians. Where do we take them? We don't know what to do, she wrote. That was one of her last posts for 10 days. Reporters Without Borders and the Committee to Protect Journalists called on Israeli authorities to disclose her whereabouts and to be transparent about journalists who have been detained in the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital, where there appears to be a telecommunications blackout. On Friday morning, Abu Sultan was back online with a brief message. I survived. The Israeli military says it's conducting a precise operation in preventing harm to civilians. NPR could not immediately reach Abu Sultan for further detail. Aya Batraoui, NPR News.
Federal investigators say Tennessee is one of about a dozen states giving their public, historically black university less money than their predominantly white counterparts. Catherine Sweeney of member station WPLN reports the state has only one HBUC and has now cut the university's governing board.
Governor Bill Lee signed a bill to vacate the board and immediately replaced most of its members. Supporters of the move say the board needed a shakeup because of mismanagement. Over the years, several audits have found money problems, like housing shortages, noncompliance with federal programs, and poor spending oversight. Critics agree TSU is struggling, but they say it's not mismanagement, it's a lack of resources. A federal investigation into state funding of HBCUs found that Tennessee underfunded TSU by more than $2 billion over the past few decades. The state has admitted to underfunding, but only by about $500 million. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Sweeney in Nashville.
In Connecticut, funeral services were held today for former Senator Joe Lieberman, who died this week at the age of 82. Political dignitaries, family, and friends gathered at a synagogue in his hometown of Stamford today, including his former running mate, Al Gore.
We laughed together, fought like hell together for what we wanted our country to be. Prayed together, thought for a season we had won together, but...
As Al Gore's running mate in 2000, Lieberman became the first Jewish American on the presidential ticket of one of the two major parties. Recently, he served as the founding chairman of the centrist No Labels group that's floating a unity ticket for the 2024 presidential race. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. There is a new partnership to monitor Kodiak Island beaches for harmful algal blooms, which spread marine toxins, causing paralytic shellfish poisoning. As KMXT's Brian Venwa reports, academic, federal, and tribal entities are working together to better understand which waters are most susceptible to the toxins.
Paralytic shellfish poisoning is caused by a marine toxin that's spread by harmful algal blooms. Humans can contract PSP when they eat shellfish contaminated by the toxin, which can be fatal. It's become a bigger concern in recent decades, particularly in Kodiak. Right now, any shellfish harvested around the island needs to be sent to labs to test for toxins, which is mostly done off-island. Andy Wall is the Environmental Program Supervisor for the Kodiak Area Native Association, which facilitates those tests.
You know, generally you go out with a bucket, you sacrifice 6 to 8 of those shellfish, you send them to us, we'll ship them off to Sitka, and we'll help interpret the results.
It's kind of a guessing game whether or not the places where people harvest shellfish will have low or high levels of toxins that cause PSP. But the Kodiak Area Native Association, Alaska Sea Grant, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have partnered to monitor various beaches for harmful algal blooms around Kodiak starting this year. NOAA has committed $1.5 million to pay for the testing and monitoring on land and even support some research offshore aboard the NOAA research vessel Oscar Dyson. The funding is expected to last for 5 years. David Kidwell is the director of the Competitive Research Program at NOAA's National Center for Coastal Ocean Science, which funds the research.
Alaska really is ground zero for a lot of the concerns we have around paralytic shellfish poisoning, harmful algal blooms, and that's in part due to the changing climate. We know that a lot of these species are moving further north than they used to be, but also the heavy reliance on subsistence use of those resources, the cultural significance of them, as well as just the vast shoreline.
In Kodiak, Candace Wall says some of their test locations so far include Mission Beach, South Trident Basin, as well as several spots along the island's road system.
Our staff will be going out and collecting shellfish water quality and phytoplankton data from those locations. If anybody wants to submit samples outside of those locations, that's strongly encouraged.
Wall says the whole point of the project is to test areas where shellfish are harvested. Julie Matwiyu is a Marine Advisory Program agent in Kodiak for Alaska Sea Grant. She studied PSB and harmful algal blooms for years. She says locals have known about toxins in shellfish for a long time.
It's been around for a long time. There's written records back in the 1800s. The Iktik culture and practices have demonstrated that the way they handle shellfish, they knew about PSB.
Matt Wiyu says part of the problem with paralytic shellfish poisoning is that it can be unpredictable.
You can monitor one beach and it's highly toxic and go to the next beach and it might not be.
She says the monitoring project could make HABs more predictable soon, though. Part of the hope for the partnership is to create a forecast for harmful algal blooms to predict what areas will have high levels of toxins, but that's still years away. For now, the only way to ensure safety from subsistence harvests is by testing samples. Matt Wiyu says she hopes to have testing on Kodiak Island soon, but that will take some time, too. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venwa.
The federal government says Alaska's education department owes almost $30 million to 4 school districts. The issue stems from the way the state reduced funding when it doled out COVID-19 relief money. KDLL's Riley Board has the story.
The issue gained public attention earlier this year when a December letter to Alaska Education Commissioner Dina Bishop from the Federal Department of Education began circulating. It said that during the COVID pandemic, when the state received federal relief funds, it inequitably reduced the state contribution to certain districts. The letter gave the state 30 days to submit a plan to resolve the issue by paying those districts. Since then, the state has gone back and forth with the feds, whose assessment now shows the state owes even more money to districts than originally described. The latest letter, dated March 27th, contains the most resounding consequence yet. The federal government is placing a condition on the relief funds and is designating the state as a high-risk grantee. It says if the state appropriates the funding for the districts within 30 days, that designation will be lifted. The latest numbers include about $9.5 million for the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District, $16.5 million for Anchorage, $3 million for Fairbanks, and $200,000 for Juneau. Clayton Holland, superintendent of the Kenai School District, says that money could be life-changing.
We're nearing the end of a budget cycle that, preparing for next year's budget, which has a you know, over $13 million in deficit, and it would mean it's a tremendous amount to us.
This week, the district's finance committee sat down to plan for a budget with no increase to state funding, which included vast cuts to staff and programs. But they didn't factor in any of the money described by the federal government, which could erase the district's deficit if combined with savings, because Holland says the district has been very out of the loop on when or if that money could come their way.
The lack of commitment from anyone at the state level about anything related to it has been concerning. So we've been completely open about these letters and what we're hearing, but very concerned because there's no confirmation that, you know, indeed anything will be added to our budget.
Holland says he did talk to Bishop earlier this month, and she told him that if the money did come through, it wouldn't be until the next fiscal year. Thursday morning, the Alaska Legislature's Senate majority announced plans to hold an emergency hearing about the high-risk grantee designation and how it could affect other federal funding. Senator Lukey Tobin, who chairs the Senate Education Committee, says the state has assured legislators that it would solve the issue, but now that doesn't appear to be true.
As recent as early March, we received a letter that indicated the state continued to not meet those federal stipulations to bring us back into full compliance with the agreement we made when we accepted those COVID relief funds from the federal government for education.
The hearing is set for next Wednesday, but Tobin says state education officials declined the invitation.
So it's concerning that after almost 2 years of noncompliance and now this hammer coming down from the federal government, we still aren't receiving clear, direct communication from our administrative branch.
Commissioner Bishop did not respond to a list of questions by airtime. But in a press release Thursday afternoon, the department says it disputes the letter's claim that it has not equitably distributed funds and claims the feds have moved the goalposts on their requirements. According to the March 27th letter, Alaska is the only state that has not met the federal requirements for equitable distribution of the relief funds. The state now has 10 days to respond to the feds if they want the high-risk designation to be reconsidered. In Soldotna, I'm Riley Ward.
There was a small volcanic eruption on Atka Island on Wednesday night. According to the Alaska Volcano Observatory, it was short-lived and no ash emissions have been observed in satellite images. Korovin Volcano exploded shortly after 7:30 Wednesday evening. It's one of several volcanoes on Atka Island that make up a group known as the Atka Volcanic Complex. The volcanoes are located about 10 miles north of the community of Atka. As of now, the AVO hasn't received any reports from locals who noticed the small explosion. The eruption was detected from local infrasound and seismic data, followed by a few minutes of seismic shaking. Michelle Coombs is a geologist with AVO. She says in 2019, the organization updated the volcano's monitoring network, which allows scientists to quickly detect small explosions like the one that occurred last night. Coombs says last night's eruption was likely hot gases breaking free from the summit of Korovin Volcano, and chances are the volcano will return to its sleep state soon, something it typically does based on past similar eruptions. However, the AVO did raise the aviation and alert levels for the Atka Volcano Complex due to the recent unrest and continued seismic activity. According to Coombs, small explosions don't often happen there. The last time the volcanic activity at the complex increased its advisory level was in August of 2021. The AVO will continue to monitor the volcanic activity. The House Finance Committee is working through its latest draft of the state budget. Committee lawmakers rejected a roughly $3,500 permanent fund dividend on Thursday. Some House Republicans are vowing to try again later, but as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, the final figure is likely to wind up significantly lower.
How much should every Alaskan get for their PFD? Well, depends who you ask. House Finance Committee Co-Chair Delena Johnson, a Palmer Republican, says it should be about $2,300. That's the amount in the House's latest draft of the state's operating budget, and it includes both a PFD and an energy relief check meant to offset high costs.
We've tried in our office to thread a very fine line of getting the highest PFD that we can for folks that need it now.
But as you might imagine, not everyone agrees. The PFD is, after all, one of the most hotly debated issues in the legislature every year. And it's not necessarily a party line issue. If you ask another House Finance Committee co-chair, Nome Democratic Representative Neil Foster, the PFD should be the amount determined by a formula in state law. This year, it'd be about $3,500. He offered the proposal as a budget amendment at a recent House Finance Committee meeting.
I know that my constituents back home, you know, they really do need, this PFD. If we reduce the PFD, it is a regressive tax on lower and middle income folks, on families across Alaska, and I don't want to go there.
Foster is a member of the Republican-led House Majority Caucus, and it's a position shared by Governor Mike Dunleavy and many of Foster's fellow caucus members, but not all.
In order to pay a statutory dividend, this state either has to reduce its expenditures on government or tax people. Those are your two options. You have no other options.
That's Fairbanks Republican Representative Will Stapp objecting to the $800 million cost of boosting the dividend to $3,500. To make his point, he outlined a series of cuts that would free up $800 million, closing all of the state's prisons and courts and shutting down the Department of Public Safety, among other things.
I believe that the size and scope of our government can absolutely be reduced. I don't believe you can cut $1 billion out of it. I don't believe you can cut $801 million out of it because you would have catastrophic consequences.
Stapp was joined in opposition by members of the House's mostly Democratic and Independent Minority Caucus. Here's Ketchikan Independent Representative Dan Ortez.
We've heard over and over again that the statutory PFD, although it would be nice to receive, is in no way sustainable for future generations.
The $800 million necessary for the PFD boost would have come from a supersized draw of the spendable portion of the permanent fund, the earnings reserve account. That account is the state's biggest source of general purpose money. The state draws down a consistent portion of the fund's value, currently 5%, to fund schools, prisons, and other state services. And the state's never gone above that maximum in state law. But Foster's proposal would require pushing this year's draw north of that figure, and legislative budget analysts say that's risky. That proposal failed 3-8 in the Finance Committee in two separate votes, but supporters vowed to try again once the budget comes to the House floor. But over in the Senate, Finance Committee co-chair Senator Burt Stedman says even the $2,300 dividend in the draft House budget faces long odds.
It's highly unlikely that this size of dividend will materialize in the final budget because there's such an extensive amount of issues that haven't been expensed yet.
Stedman, a Sitka Republican, says there's a lot that isn't included in the House budget. Between bills that have passed the House or Senate, expected increases in union contract costs, and other items, he says it's more than a quarter billion. The House's roughly $2,300 dividend represents 30% of this year's draw from the permanent fund. Stedman says that's too much. He's advocating for paring that back to a quarter of the draw, or just under $1,600.
I think we have, the Senate has the right position in that if we had a 25% dividend, we have a high likelihood that we can maintain that dividend going forward into the future.
Lawmakers are hoping to pass the operating budget out of the House by mid-April. Senators hope to finalize the budget in the closing days of the legislative session in mid-May. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Bethel Nonprofits publicly unveiled a groundbreaking project earlier this month, a permanent supportive housing building meant to help stabilize the lives of chronically homeless individuals in the Western Alaska Hub community. KYUK's Sage Smiley has this report.
Sunlight streams in through the second-story window of a bright little studio apartment in the new Utsuk Place building.
I will say I think this is now the best view in all of Bethel. I think we are one of the highest buildings.
Jayla Milford is the executive director of Bethel Winter House, the city's emergency overnight housing shelter. She's also now the executive director of the community's permanent supportive housing project, Utsuk Place, connected by a breezeway to the shelter. From this vantage point, we can see small planes landing at the airport 2.5 miles away.
We're essentially at horizon level, and so you can see for miles right now, which makes this a pretty cool, pretty neat view. And you do get a lot of sunlight in these rooms because of that, which will be great for individuals that live here.
Each of the 24 studio apartments in the building has a kitchen with full-size appliances, basic furniture, and a private bathroom. The bathrooms are stocked with products. There are laundry supplies in the closet and a cup full of cooking utensils on the counters. Cupboards and drawers hold other kitchenware.
The people moving into these apartments haven't lived somewhere stably in most likely years. So we're trying to start them off with a baseline of everything you'd possibly need, and then we're going to work with them there to get any resources they might be missing or they use.
Susan Murphy was one of the first volunteers and supporters of Bethel Winter House. After she retired from the school district, she began volunteering at the Catholic Church.
And until that time, I, like most of the people in Bethel, did not realize that there were homeless people in Bethel. I saw them on the street, but I really didn't see them.
The idea behind permanent supportive housing projects is that people need stable housing to be able to stabilize other parts of their lives.
If you don't have a place to stay, it's difficult to find work. It's difficult to find a place to go home and just relax. So this has been a dream of mine for a long time.
With a reliable and safe place to live, calls to police, emergency medical services, and community crisis resources drop. People are healthier when they have a permanent place to live. The supportive aspect of permanent supportive housing is important as well. Individuals who have been living day-to-day on streets, in shelters, or other unstable housing situations often need extra help setting up appointments, accessing services, or support groups. That's been a frustration of the Bethel Winter House's board, says board president Sharon Chakuchin.
By the end of the season, sometimes a person is as close to supportive housing that we've been able to give them. So by March, sometimes they look like they know which end is up. You know, they've been having a place to stay. And then the winter house closes because winter is over, and it's so impossible to keep it up.
The new permanent supportive housing was constructed to be able to share resources with Bethel Winter House. The buildings share an entrance and an elevator, and supportive housing residents will be able to do laundry in the winter house facilities. Bethel's new permanent supportive housing is one of the first of its kind in rural Alaska, along with a 15-unit project in Nome that's in its final stages as well. Dozens of project partners and community members crammed into the common area and breezeway of the new permanent supportive housing building in early March. Winter House Board Vice President Eva Malvich sliced through a royal purple ribbon.
Let's get it going. Let's start. Here's to Bethel and everything that we did together.
Ribbon cut, the crowd spread out throughout the unlocked studio apartments. Bethel's point in time count from this year, a nationwide survey of homelessness on a specific day, surveyed 80 people experiencing housing instability on January 30th as the temperature in Bethel dropped to below 20 degrees Fahrenheit. Almost all of them were looking for a permanent place to live, and the majority were looking for somewhere in Bethel.
24 individuals will be able to have a home for the first time in most likely years.
Upstairs, Milford, the Winter House and Dotsuck Place executive director, looks out over the sunny tundra.
Most of them will come directly from the shelter. So our shelter numbers will decrease, our daily shelter numbers will decrease because they are in an actual apartment, and these individuals will finally have a place to live, but they don't have to be asked to leave.
Over the coming weeks, the rooms in the Utsuk Place will slowly fill with residents. Some may spend the rest of their lives in their apartments, and that's the point. It'll be their home for as long as they need. In Bethel, I'm Sage Smiley.
The Fed's preferred inflation measure rises. I'm Henry Epp with the Marketplace Minute. An inflation index that Federal Reserve leaders pay close attention to rose 0.3% last month. Core PCE, which measures prices excluding food and energy, rose 2.8% compared to a year ago. That's a slightly slower rate than in December and January. Both wholesalers and retailers grew their inventories last month by 0.5%, according to new data from the Census Bureau. But over the past year, retail inventories fell slightly, while wholesale inventories are up over 5%. The same report shows the U.S. trade deficit widened slightly last month. Imports to the U.S. outpaced exports by nearly $92 billion, though both imports and exports each grew by several billion dollars. I'm Henry Epp with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the 29th day of March, the year 2024. Sun rose today at 7:44. It will set again at 8:45. That will give us 13 hours and 1 minute of glorious daylight. That's a gain of 5 minutes compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 53 degrees set in 1970, and our record low temperature was 7 degrees set in 1952. Currently 42 degrees, overcast skies, southeast winds at 8 miles per hour at the airport, where they are also indicating 10 miles of visibility. Look for a chance of rain this afternoon, at least until 2 p.m. or so, then a slight chance of rain after 5. Mostly cloudy otherwise, with a high near 44, south winds to 15. For tonight, a slight chance of rain before 8, then a slight chance of rain after 2 a.m. Mostly cloudy tonight, too, with a low around 36, south winds to 5. And for tomorrow, it will be breezier and wetter. Rain mainly before 5 p.m., high near 44 tomorrow, southeast winds to 20, turning to the southwest and could gust as high as 30. Over the weekend, look for rain and snow, 40% chance of snow on Monday, and mostly sunny skies on Tuesday. We have an incoming tide. The tide has turned in the last hour or so. Our next high tide here on the east side will happen at 5:27. That will be a 6.4-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 10:51 p.m. of 2.4 feet. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 5:50 p.m. and be 11.6 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 11:26 p.m. of 3 1/3 feet. Mariners, here's your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Gale warning for today and tomorrow. South winds to 35 knots today. Should be coming down to southwest 25 this afternoon, 11-foot seas. For tomorrow, south 30, becoming southwest 45 in the afternoon, 9-foot seas building to 14 feet tomorrow afternoon on our east side. Over in the Shilikoff Strait, gale warning for tomorrow. Southeast 25 today with 6-foot seas. South 20 tonight with 5-foot seas. And for tomorrow on our west side, east winds to 20 knots, becoming southwest 40 in the afternoon, 5-foot seas building to 10 feet tomorrow afternoon. And for Saturday night, look for southwest winds of 40 knots and seas to 11 feet in the Shelikoff. Well, it's happening tonight. The Island Trails Network Film Festival, the Kodiak Outdoor Film Festival, will be happening tonight at 7 p.m. in the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. Doors open at 6. Films begin at 7. Again, that's tonight at the Gerald C. Opens at 6. The Island Trails Network Outdoor Film Festival. Also tonight is the Kodiak College Cabin Fever Reliever and Business After Hours. Enjoy a night of food and fun at Kodiak College. That's tonight from 5 to 7 p.m. Engage in a variety of mini sessions from their community education courses. Learn about Kodiak College programs. Visit their community education art show. And enjoy complimentary appetizers and beverages. That's all happening at the community college tonight, starting at 5. Tomorrow, it's the next big Isle Bells concert, March Gladness. That will be happening tomorrow at 4 p.m. in the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium Choral Pod. 4 p.m. tomorrow. The Kodiak Archipelago Regional Management Body for the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council, or the AMBCC, will conduct its spring meeting on Monday. That's happening from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. The purpose of the meeting is to make subsistence harvest recommendations for migratory birds. Recommendations approved in this meeting will be advanced to the spring 2025 statewide AMBCC meeting. The meeting will be held both in person and at the Shunack Tribe Conference Room virtually via Zoom. For the meeting link or additional information, contact Daniel Smith at dsmith@shunack.org. That's SUNAQ.org. Or call him on the phone at 907-512-6685. Next Monday, the Board of Education will be having a work session and special meeting. The work session will begin at 6:30 p.m. and be followed immediately by the special meeting. That will be happening in the District Services Conference Room, which is number F-140 of the old high school wing. The meeting will also be streamed live through Teams. Meeting login information is posted on the Kodiak Island Borough School District website. Look under the Board of Education tab. Action items in the special meeting include approval of the FY24 grants, approval of expenditure of over $50,000, and approval of the FY25 certificated contracts. Meetings happening next Tuesday include the Women's Bay Service Area Board. They'll be having their regular meeting in the Women's Bay Fire Hall at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday. Also on Tuesday, the Hazard Mitigation Plan will be having, I guess the Hazard Mitigation Plan team will be having a meeting for the plan team update. That'll be happening via Zoom at 6 p.m. And Galley Tables. The next one's coming up Friday, April 5th. That's Call of the Wild.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181. Fax us at 486-2733 or email psa@kmxt.org.